Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 63, The Psychology of Affluence, November 29th, 2006. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I think the main reason that I wrote the book is because it's a world that is so misunderstood and so glorified and so held up as the ideal place to want to be or get to. And that's so unfortunate because it's such an empty world, unless the money, of course, is used for the good of mankind.
That was the voice of my guest, Jesse O'Neill, M.A., who is the author of the book, The Golden Ghetto, The Psychology of Affluence. Jesse was born to wealth. She's the granddaughter of Charles Irwin Wilson, past president of General Motors and Secretary of Defense under President Dwight D. Eisenhower. It was Wilson who immortalized the equating of financial and patriotic success with the now famous comment, "What's good for General Motors is good for the country and vice versa." Today, Jesse O'Neill is founder and director of the Affluenza Project, president of the Affluenza Healing and Education Foundation, Incorporated, and a licensed therapist. As a therapist, O'Neill specializes in the psychology of money/wealth and how it affects both our personal and professional bottom line, or productivity, and the treatment of affluenza through a myriad of educational and therapeutic services. She graduated Phi Beta Kappa with a Bachelor of Arts degree in English from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and later earned a master's degree in psychology and counseling. She's an entrepreneur, a watercolor artist, and the mother of two daughters. Now let's get into the interview. Jesse O'Neill, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
Our mutual friend Lee Jampolsky loaned me a copy of your book, The Golden Ghetto, The Psychology of Affluence, and he suggested you'd be a good person to interview, and of course, everyone's interested in money in one way or another. Why don't you start out, as you do in the book, by telling us your story?
My own story, huh?
Yeah. You weren't expecting that, huh?
Yeah, I thought you were going to let me talk about other people. Well, let's see. I am the granddaughter of Charles E. Wilson. His nickname was Engine Charlie. He was the president of General Motors, and following that, he became Secretary of Defense under Dwight D. Eisenhower. And my mother was one of his six children. So I was raised in a fair amount of affluence and surrounded by other wealthy families and children. When I was in my 20s, I went into recovery and quit drinking and began to search, as many young people do, for the reasons behind some of my dis-ease. And in so doing, I began to look at the effects that money had on my family and me.
Yeah, in your book, you detail a lot of difficulties in your early years that were created by money. Can you spell out some of those? I mean, what was the source of the pain?
Well, I think one of the problems with many children of affluence, and myself as well, is I was raised by nannies. I was raised by surrogates.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, the message that I got was that for whatever reason, I wasn't good enough for my parents to spend time with me. So I was raised by surrogates, and also there's the issue of values and traditions and beliefs that that are lost when you're raised by someone outside of your own family system. Mm-hmm. You get beliefs and values, but they're somebody else's. And so that was certainly one issue. I was isolated by my wealth, as were the few other children that lived in my neighborhood.
Yeah, can you say, what do you mean isolated by your wealth?
Well, I went to a very, very small private school. You know, everybody else in Delray Beach just about went to the public school. So money, in a way, sets you apart. Mm-hmm. It becomes almost like a film between you and the people that are normal,
yeah,
so to speak. And so, of course, I don't think you realize that so much when you're a young person, as you don't realize a lot of things. But when I began to look back at some of the effects, you know, the old thing that a lot of people talk about where things are substituted for love, you know, that was certainly a part of my childhood. My parents gave me a lot of material things, but very little of their own attention. They were both alcoholics. Of course, that's not something that is only true of wealthy families, but the money does allow wealthy alcoholics to drink with some impunity.
Mm-hmm.
I call it the buyout principle. You know, you can buy yourself out of uncomfortable situations or negative consequences of drinking.
Or misbehavior of various sorts.
Or misbehavior, correct,
yeah,
that might result from the drinking.
Right.
So I was, you know, raised by nannies. During the day, the house was relatively quiet, and then when all of the help left at 5 o'clock, then all hell broke loose. You know, my father would come home drunk, my mother would have been drinking, I was an only child, and so there was very little other than the size of the house to buffer me from their anger and distress. And so I would normally sort of find the farthest corner away from them that I could get. And if it was daytime, I spent a lot of time outside. We lived in Florida, so the weather was good. And I had bicycles and horses and boats and lots of avenues of escape. And then as soon as I was able to, I discovered other substances, food being probably the primary substance, and then drugs and alcohol along the way.
And you were talking about isolation, and I wonder if as you got older, another form that the isolation took was not knowing who you could trust in terms of if people who didn't come from a wealthy background tried to befriend you or romantically engage you, would there always be a question of, you know, what's their underlying motive?
I think that's always there to some degree. I've certainly, as I've aged and hopefully gained some wisdom, I have developed a pretty good sense about why someone's hanging around, although I am still susceptible to being, you know, sideswiped. And I think it does still isolate me. I don't think that that's necessarily changed, particularly in the dating world. I'm single and have retired early because I don't have to work. And so when I meet men, if the man happens to be in a lower economic strata than I'm in, it may not bother me, but it oftentimes bothers the man.
Sure, I can understand that.
And so I think particularly wealthy women struggle with that. It doesn't seem to be so true in my research. It doesn't seem to be so true of men. Men seem to sit more comfortably with the mantle of wealth,
mm-hmm,
than a woman does.
Yeah, you know, early on in your book, and I forget the terms in which you describe this, but there's kind of a reaction that people have to your story, to your research of, you know, oh, poor little rich girl.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah, there's a great deal of prejudice towards wealthy people. It's called wealthism.
Just like ageism or sexism.
Yeah, it's just another ism. It's like racism or ageism or any of the other isms, in that, once again, it separates people from one another.
Interesting.
Rather than bringing them together.
Yeah, even as I mentioned to family and friends, oh, I'm going to, you know, the topic of this interview, that was the sort of reaction that was immediately elicited. You know, oh, well, yep. I should have such a problem.
I should have those problems, right?
Yes, right.
Yeah. Unfortunately, unless someone is open-minded and well-read and either already knows about the topic or at least is willing to discuss it in an open-minded way, that's oftentimes the response, even with people that I know, mm-hmm. even with friends of mine, sometimes wow. I can still detect sort of an underlying, oh, well, you don't have to work, so you don't understand my issues.
Yeah.
You know?
And you went beyond your own issues and actually researched a lot of other wealthy families,
yes.
right?
Mm-hmm. What, I sure did.
Yeah. Tell us what you found.
Well, I think probably the most damaging effect of wealth is on the second and third generations. And what showering children with material things does is it creates an inability to delay gratification and tolerate frustration.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the two primary symptoms of affluenza. Also a sense of entitlement, low self-esteem, a lack of self-confidence. You know, by the very act of giving our children money, we take away their ability to know whether they can make it on their own or not. And so it's a real double-edged sword.
Yes.
You know, how do you leave the fruits of your labor or the fruits of your father's labor or whoever's labor it may have been
mm-hmm.
to your children in a way that empowers them rather than disables them?
Right. I wonder if by any chance you were able to see the HBO film Born Rich, which was
made. I didn't see it, but I had a couple people mention it to me, and I've not seen it. But
I'll bet you could get a copy of that on the internet. I think you'd find it fascinating. It was made by the heir of the Johnson & Johnson family fortune, and on the cusp of his 21st birthday, he went out and interviewed his very wealthy friends, and you really see this isolated world that you've been describing, and also mm-hmm. the kind of existential issues that these young people mm-hmm. struggle mm-hmm. with as a result.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, it again is a double-edged sword because it does afford you the luxury to struggle with those existential issues. You know, you don't have to worry about a roof over your head. You don't have to worry about food on the table or clothes on your back. And so you're sort of thrust into another arena of living.
And having to figure out, what's the meaning of life?
What's the meaning of life? And many, many people who do have to work don't have that time, really, so much.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is a different world, but it's, I think the main reason that I wrote the book is because it's a world that is so misunderstood and so glorified and so held up as the ideal place to want to be or get to, and that's so unfortunate because it's such an empty world, unless the money, of course, is used for the good of mankind.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the way that it's held up as the carrot in our culture.
Right.
You know, the carrot is all the things that you can get with that money. And so it's really, it does both the haves and the have-nots a disservice because it sets everybody up for disappointment.
Right, right. You know, I wonder if we've turned
it's a lie. It's what I call the myth of the American dream. It's a lie.
Yeah. Yeah, you say our culture suffers from many misconceptions about wealth, and you enumerate a number of them in your book. Can you review for us what some of those misconceptions are? I know it's been a few years since you wrote your book, and
yeah.
I wrote a book, and if anybody asked me about some of the things I said
remember
in my book,
what you wrote?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would remember.
I think the biggest one is that money buys happiness, and of course we say we know it doesn't, but we don't act as though we know it doesn't. You know, so people go through their lives reaching for this golden or brass ring, and when they reach it, it's plastic. Mm-hmm. And if they don't reach it, then they've wasted their whole life striving for something that isn't really worth striving for. And if they do reach it, they realize that, once again, they've spent their whole life striving for something that, in fact, is not the essence of happiness or contentment.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's the, you know, that's the biggest crime. But, you know, that money buys happiness is certainly one misconception. You know, I can't remember exactly what I enumerated.
I've got your book in front of me. Maybe I'll find
maybe
it.
Maybe you could.
I don't know if I can quickly go to it or not. You use the term affluenza. Mm-hmm. Is that a term that you coined, or?
It's a term that I plucked out of a very obscure research article when I was doing my research, and it was not used the way that I subsequently used it. And the way that I've defined it is unhealthy or dysfunctional relationship with money or wealth or the pursuit of it. So it doesn't just have to do with people who already have money. It's the imbalance around the pursuit of money in our culture. And then globally, it's a backup of the flow of money that results in a unbalance or disharmony, both spiritual and emotional and political,
mm-hmm.
Between the haves and the have-nots and between the, around the world. So it creates, you know, political and ultimately wars. I mean, you know, wars are fought over religion and money.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, I did find that place in the book. It says, the following six ideas lay the groundwork for understanding the psychology of affluence and for finding a way out of the golden ghetto. And so many people are looking for a way into the golden ghetto, but
right.
As you suggest, it's a misguided search often. The first one that you mention is the psychological dysfunctions of affluenza, which you've just been talking about. And you mm-hmm. say they are generational and often set in motion by the family founder. And so that would be...
Yes,
the
affluenza is generational.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like many other diseases. It's passed from one generation to the next.
Okay, and then the...
A preoccupation with externals to the loss of the internal.
Uh-huh.
A loss of affect. They may be in that list further down.
Yeah. Your second point is workaholism, which you say workaholism, mm-hmm. I see people that have a lot of money and they would have enough money that they could just stop, you know, but they don't.
Mm-hmm.
They keep amassing.
Yeah.
So work.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not about how much money you make. It's about the act of making the money.
Mm-hmm.
So if you make $1 million one quarter and you only make $500,000 the second quarter, in your own mind you have failed.
Mm-hmm.
Because failure is a result of how much money you make. How
yes.
you perceive success and failure in your life is a direct mirror of how much money you make.
Right. Right. Your second point here, workaholism isolates the family founder as well as individual family members. Absence of parents and turnover of reliable caretakers create abandonment and trust issues for the children mm-hmm. of affluence mm-hmm. that follow them into adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
mm-hmm.
what you are describing as your childhood experience.
Yeah, it was interesting. My second book, which never got published, was called Money Dearest.
Oh, I love the title.
Freeing Your Family from the Myth of the American Dream. And one of the things that I did more extensive research on after the Golden Ghetto was bonding and how children form bonds with caretakers and what happens when those bonds are repeatedly broken. So, you know, you turn the child over to a caretaker, and then what happens frequently is the mother then gets jealous of the relationship between the child and the caretaker, fires the caretaker, and gets someone new who the child is not so attached to in the beginning, and then the process is repeated. And so what happens ultimately is children quit forming bonds. They just stop because it's too painful. And, you know, and that goes into all parts of your life. You know, you have attachment bonds to jobs. You have attachment to cultures. You have attachment to your community. You have attachment to your husband, your children. And so if that ability to form an attachment bond is damaged, it goes carries all the way throughout your lifetime. So we're now seeing the results, because those children that were raised by, in my day, it was au pairs when I had my kids. Everybody got an au pair. Well, the au pairs had to go back to Europe or back to their home country after 6 months. Mm-hmm. So then you get another au pair. And many of my children's peers were raised by au pairs. Well, what happens is they now have very little ability to form an attachment bond.
And that must be passed on to their children.
Sure.
They would have little ability to be fully nurturing.
Engage or role model what attachment looks like.
Right. Moving on to your point three here. It says, inherited or sudden wealth can create a false sense of entitlement, a loss of future motivation, and an inability to delay gratification and tolerate frustration.
Yes.
I think you spoke to that. Four, inheriting money can seriously damage self-esteem, self-worth, and self-confidence. And I think you spoke to that. Five, society holds a highly ambivalent attitude toward the wealthy and often manifests as a reverse snobbery or wealthism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's interesting, that ambivalent attitude that you talk about. I can see that. I think I'm aware of that in myself.
It's interesting. We, on one hand, we hold the wealthy up as the icons and the folks that we look to save the world, you know.
Right.
And we have very high expectations around how the wealthy should perform. On the other hand, when they fall on their face, we rejoice.
Yeah, we kind of need to tear them down and the gossip pages.
Kill the king,
and, yeah.
You know? So, and of course, what has happened is the wealthy have become less and less inclined to reach out and help, because they're aware, we're aware of that attitude, and it's pretty hard to want to help somebody who hates you.
Mm. I wonder, though, if we've turned a corner with Bill Gates and...
It seems that we have in a lot of ways. I know that philanthropy has taken a big leap in the last few years, and a lot of it is due to several of the heavy hitters out there.
And
it's a good thing. It's a very, very, very good thing.
It does feel that way.
Yep.
And then the sixth point that you make in this section is the idea of the American dream, that the pursuit of money is among the highest of aspirations, and that affluence is synonymous with happiness, is a persistent and pernicious cultural myth.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there's been a bunch of psychological research that shows that the correlation between happiness and money is very slight, you know, once a person rises above the level of absolute poverty.
Exactly.
And yet this myth persists for some reason.
Yep, it does.
I was told, I don't know if this is true, but I was told that Mother Teresa, when she visited this country, remarked that while the people in Calcutta were materially very poor, they seemed to her to be spiritually more rich, and that experienced the greatest spiritual poverty here.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I remember that. I think that's true.
Yeah.
In fact, it's so true that in many ways that's probably the reason that I no longer practice.
As a therapist?
No, not so much practice as a therapist, but I should say, I guess, consult and speak on the subject. I found it to be so discouraging and such an uphill battle.
Mm.
And I was so challenged on my ideas and research and theories that ultimately I didn't see the change or the shifts that I hoped would take place. And I certainly still hope that they take place, but I'm afraid that I'm not out there carrying the banner as much as I used to be.
Uh-huh. So you really were catching a lot of flack from this ambivalence that people in general have about the wealthy, and you were...
I just think that the allure of money is so strong that even when people know that what you're telling them is the truth, they know that they should be home with their children more. They know that they shouldn't take their BlackBerry to the soccer games. They know that they should put their family and friends in front of the pursuit of money. They still don't do it because that allure is so strong.
Yeah, there's a real kind of connection between money and addiction, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Yep, and there is an addictive quality to making money. Mm-hmm. That's why they don't stop when they have enough.
Yeah.
You know, one of the exercises I taught for a couple of years at Esalen, and one of the exercises that we did in the workshop was called What is Enough? And I would encourage my families to sit down and really think about that and really put some figures down on paper. You know, well, when we get to this benchmark, is that going to be enough? And if it is enough, then what are we going to do with the rest to make a difference in the world?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just sort of this blind accumulation and feeling like there's never enough.
Right.
I call it the never enough mentality, which is part of the addiction.
Yes.
You know, there's never enough. No matter how much I have, I want more. And so how do you counteract that? Well, one of the ways you do it is by making a decision what is enough.
Right,
you know?
Right. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I did an exercise very similar to that in a class that I was teaching on human potential.
And, oh, okay.
And I asked students to, you know, to say how much money they would see themselves needing to make, you know, within 10 years. And mm-hmm. it's sort of used that as a way to talk about these issues,
mm-hmm.
as a
mm-hmm.
springboard for it. I'm sorry to hear that second book hasn't made it into print, because you write very well. There's let me read, just so my audience can get a sense of just how strong your writing is, and also I'm interested in the content here. So I want to read a little bit here, where you comment that towards the end of life, sometimes people begin to be in touch with what's really important to them, and you quote the rhetorical question, how many people lying on their deathbeds express the regret that they should have spent more time at the office? And I think probably nobody. And then you write, but the realization of what is important in life comes not only to the very old, it also pushes persistently beneath the surface of our culture. The malaise that currently grips our country comes not from the fact that we don't have enough wealth, but from a terrifying knowledge that has begun to enter our consciousness that we have based our entire lives, our entire culture, and way of being on the wrong premise. In our naivete, our addictive greed, and our separation from our spiritual source, we have wandered farther and farther down the wrong road. When we awaken long enough to glimpse this frightening truth, it's all too easy to frantically reach for another fix to numb the pain. Another house, another spouse, another child, another car, another dress, another ring, another lie. I find that very powerful.
Well, thank you. The truth is often powerful.
Yes. Well, in the last chapter of your book, you quote from the New Testament where Christ says it would be easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to get into heaven. What's your take on that?
Well, apparently there's a double meaning to the word used in the Bible, and our interpretation of it is one, and there is another interpretation. But because I don't have the book in front of me, I can't tell you what that is.
Oh, yes. That comes back to me. Somewhere I've heard that the eye of the needle isn't literally...
The eye of the needle is
not literally the eye of a needle, but
it's
a small
arched
gate,
yes,
to the city.
Yes, and so the man with all of the stuff has a harder time getting through the arch, I think, was the... if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah. And so metaphorically...
It's metaphoric.
The more stuff that we're dragging behind us.
Dragging behind us, yes.
The harder... Yeah. And some, you know, a lot of us have this feeling of we have too much stuff, and it's I find it's hard to get rid of stuff. I try to get rid of my stuff, and I seem to acquire it faster than I can get rid of it.
Well, it's interesting because I have being an only child, and both my parents are dead, and so I inherited not only money, but I inherited a lot of things, you know, furniture and dishes and
dishware.
And whenever I I've been de-stuffing for a long time and simplifying, and I'm in sort of the final push right now of trying to sell my large home and get rid of 90% of the things inside of it. And whenever I talk about, you know, well, I'm going to sell that desk or I'm going to put that desk on consignment or that chair, somebody will say, oh, but it's so beautiful. And it was your grandmother's or it was your mother's. And I go, I know, but I have too much stuff. So there's this sort of, how can you, you know, let go of this heritage? And so you're sort of torn.
Yes, yes. It's really paradoxical. It's so hard to let go of the stuff, and yet there's such a feeling of freedom when one does.
Yes. Oh, definitely. And it's so much, I learned that lesson a long time ago. You would have thought I would have done more about it by this time, but when my girls were little, we went to horse shows around the Midwest and East Coast, and after a couple years of staying in Holiday Inns, I bought a small camper. And I remember driving away from the farm one day, and I had the kids, and I had the dogs, and I had, you know, food and clothing. And I thought to myself, you know, I have everything I need in this camper.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
You know, if everything that I just left were not there when I got back, I'd be okay. And it was a very interesting realization. And I loved that camper because I could get up in the morning and make the bed and sweep the, you know, 2x4 floor, and it was clean.
Yeah.
I was done.
Right, right.
You know?
Now, many of the issues that you address in your book do relate to problems that derive from inheriting great wealth.
Mm-hmm.
But is it different when people earn their way to great wealth? Does that make the problems go away?
Well, I think the main difference is that the person who earns the wealth has the self-confidence and the self-worth because they made it on their own.
Mm-hmm.
However, if they aren't made aware or if they don't learn about the possible pitfalls by the middle or end of their life, they will often end up with affluenza, sort of unbeknownst. You know, they'll develop it.
They'll develop this, become addicted to the process.
Yeah, they'll become addicted to the process. They begin to think that they're special because they've made all this money. They develop the false sense of entitlement. I mean, you see that in Hollywood all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, treat me special because I'm rich or I'm a star.
Yeah.
And so they develop the entitlement issues. They develop the less attractive attributes of affluenza. And then they pass those down to their children.
Yeah. So how were you able to come to terms with the fact of your wealth to the extent that you have been able to come to terms with it?
Well, I think because I wrote the book and because I've done the work that I've done around affluenza, I feel that I used my money in a way that benefited mankind. Now that I'm not out on the road speaking and practicing so much, I am more involved in philanthropy and really have learned to prefer and find that I prefer a quieter place rather than out on the stage. I'd rather be behind the stage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's been more comfortable for me, and I still feel as though I'm giving back. I think the main way that one can have one's money become a gift rather than a burden is by giving it away.
Mm-hmm.
I call it the joy response in my book, but I think that the greatest gift we can give our children is to teach them and show them the joy that comes from touching another person's life in a positive way. And that is also an addictive experience. You know, many people try to get to it through drugs and alcohol, but that joy response, that feeling that makes tears fall down your face because you're so happy, you know, you're going to go back to that again and again and again and again. I tell the story of my daughter, Rebecca, who was 12 at the time, and we had become involved in Milwaukee with the Sojourner Truth House. And every holiday we would meet with a different family and give them a turkey and gifts and a tree and you know, sort of do the holiday for them. And we've been doing it for a number of years. And my daughter turned to me one day and she said, "Mom, I want to adopt a second family this Christmas. And I want you to take the money that you would spend on me and spend it on the family."
Mm-hmm.
And I was very touched. And I, you know, I turned to her and I said, "Well, that's wonderful, honey. And I'm happy to do that. But I'm just curious, you know, why do you want to do that?" And she said, "Because I want to feel the same way I felt last year when that little boy said to his mother, 'This is the best Christmas I ever had.'"
Mm, that's great.
And I will never forget that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just remarkable.
Yeah.
You know, for a 12-year-old to want to experience that so much again that she would give up her own Christmas, you know, was remarkable.
That's great. That's great. Well, Jesse, as we wrap things up here, I'm wondering if there are any last thoughts that you'd like to leave with our listeners who, you know, everybody has their own personal relationship to money issues and concerns, struggles, fears. It seems to be pretty universal.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any thought that you'd like to leave us with?
Well, I think there's a couple of them. I believe that most people know, if they stop and think and search their souls, whether they have a healthy relationship with money or not. And I would just recommend that if you do stop and search your soul and you discover that, in fact, your relationship with money is out of balance, that you take the time and find the resources to balance that relationship again. Because, in fact, if you don't, you really are destined, I believe, for a life of some disease and discomfort.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jesse, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're welcome. It's been an honor.
Now, by all rights, this should have been the end of our interview. However, Jesse and I continued to chat a bit after the formal part of the interview was over, and it just so happens that I did keep the recorder on, and we got into a fascinating patch, which I have her permission to include. Rather than trying to find a place to splice it into the earlier discussion, I'll just tack it on here. She had mentioned writing a second book, which hadn't been published, and so I follow up asking about the fate of that second book. Let's listen in again.
Do you think you'll get that book out there? I mean, why sit on that?
I don't know. I could have published it if I didn't want much of an advance.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to be paid for my time.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to be able to pay research people and that kind of stuff. And so I sort of stopped short of what I had done with The Golden Ghetto, which was to take a very small advance just to be able to write the book.
Right.
I didn't feel so moved to write the second one that I was willing to do it without being paid.
But it's already written or not?
No. Well, the book proposal is written and three chapters are written.
Oh, I see.
So it's not already written, but it's, you know, it's well on its way.
Yeah. Now, see, this gets at the heart of, I think, one of the places where us non-wealthy people get stuck. You could afford to publish this on your own, right? You don't
mm-hmm.
need
yes,
to make
I could.
You don't need to make money from it,
right? Right.
So it seems it's just a little paradoxical that
right. It's a motivation thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it's not about money, when you're not being motivated by money, then you have to be motivated by something else. And with the first book, I was motivated by the need to get the information out there and the need to, you know, sort of purge my soul. I mean, that was my growing experience.
Mm-hmm.
With the second one, it was more work. You know, it was information that needed to get out there, but it wasn't – I didn't have the same motivation.
And so
that is one of the issues with children of wealth. You know, if you don't have to get up in the morning to go to work, then why are you going to get up in the morning?
Mm-hmm.
You have to find the motivation somewhere else. It has to be your passion, your mission, your vision. You know, it has to really drive you because you aren't driven by money.
Okay. But yet somehow money is a marker for you in this case, since they...
Yes, and I think that's another piece of affluence. I mean, many people... in my practice would say, well, why do you charge so much for your counseling? You don't need to make the money. And the reason that I charged as much as I did was because I'm worth it.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Mm-hmm.
And what I found was when I gave my time away free, people didn't show up.
Yeah, right.
I wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm charging nothing, well, then I must not be very good, right? And so there's this very thin line that you walk. You know, well, you could discount your speaking services. Well, why would I want to, you know, fly coach, you know, be tired, go through all the hassles, get there, stand on my feet for 5 or 6 hours for nothing?
Mm-hmm.
Just because I already have money?
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting arena to be in when you have money.
Yes. You know,
you have to defend your right to charge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another problem.
Yeah.
I hope you found this interview interesting, especially taken back to back with my previous one with Randy Gage, the so-called millionaire messiah, who's made his fortune as a multi-level marketing guru and motivational speaker. Were you as struck as I was by the paradoxical nature of Jesse's relation to money as it emerged in our post-interview discussion? This is not a comment on Jesse herself as much as the interesting observation that money is such a habitual, automatic yardstick in our culture that even a wealthy person such as herself can't quite get away from using it as a measure of the worth of her efforts. Did you find yourself initially having that poor little rich girl response? That's pretty automatic too. What she refers to as wealthism? Our snap judgment that says, well, what are you complaining about? I should have your problems. Yet, if you read her very well-written book, The Golden Ghetto, you'll quickly realize that you wouldn't want the sorts of problems with which she's had to cope. Sure, money solves some of life's problems, especially if you don't have any, but it can also create a whole world of problems on its own. Well, not the money, actually, but it's our relation to it and the relation of those around us to it that can be so problematic. As I mentioned in the previous episode, once basic needs have been covered, research shows that there's little correlation between wealth and happiness. In addition, studies of people who have achieved instant wealth as a result of winning the lottery have found that this supposed good fortune has often resulted in grief. Money, stardom, fame, all potentially represent enormous power. The wisdom of myth and fairy tale alike warn against the pitfalls of power in the hands of the unwise or the unready. At this point, I suspect Randy Gage would say that I'm playing into the cultural programming that leads to a fear of success. I'm saying that money is a false god and should not be an end in itself. In Randy Gage's philosophy, selfishness is seen as the highest good. This is a philosophical argument that goes back at least as far as Aristotle, if not further. There is a line of reasoning that says that the selfless person is actually being selfish because they enjoy the experience of acting selfless. If that's the case, then that's the brand of selfishness I endorse, the kind that manifests itself in love, kindness, cooperation, and consideration of others more than competition and greed. I'm not sure what your reaction to Randy Gage was. Personally, I struggled with whether or not to do that interview. it seemed to me it might verge a bit too closely to the slick pop psychology get-rich-quick side of things. I have to wonder how much of that is sour grapes on my part, though. Randy has certainly created more money, fame, and success than I have, and I'd be a liar if I didn't admit that there's a part of me that would be attracted to that. On the other hand, I'm distrustful of Ayn Rand's worship of the ruthless entrepreneurial hero, as well as the libertarian notion that wants to cut off all government benefits from the unfortunate and the needy. And it's that sort of philosophy that Randy's drawing upon. It's not a level playing field. It never has been. And there are sharks in the water.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
As you may already know, our sponsors are Podshow and GoDaddy. Use the discount code SHRINK3 at checkout, and you can buy a domain name for a whole year at GoDaddy.com for just $6.95 instead of the usual $8.95. Christmas is coming up, and buying a vanity domain name for friends or family can make for a unique and surprising gift. You can give your friend Billy Bob Smith the domain name BillyBobSmith.com, and he'll be tickled pink. Or how about www.bestmomintheworld.org? You get the idea. Thanks to all who have taken our listener survey. We're up to 80 completed surveys, and I'm still hoping to drive that number to 100 or more in the next week or so. That way, we'll start to have enough for some meaningful statistical analysis. If you haven't filled it out yet, please do so. You'll find it at shrinkwrapradio.com/survey.htm. And also, there's a link on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. For everyone who completes the survey and includes their name and email address, I'm going to send you a link to a radio talk on dreams I gave before a live audience at the University of New Hampshire. We have 3 new additions to our Frapper map, and I want to give a big thank you and welcome to Katie in Provo, Utah, Lucy in Melbourne, Australia, and Daryl in Cape Town, South Africa. If you haven't already done so, please add yourself to our growing Frapper map. All you have to do is go to frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio, or you'll find a link on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. Plus, you'll be entered into a drawing for a free copy of a book I co-authored on the Zodiac serial killer. Now, a major Hollywood film about the Zodiac is coming out in March, so my book will provide invaluable background available nowhere else.
Hi, this is Sherry West, and you're on the couch with my brother, Dr. Dave. Hey, what are you doing on the couch with my brother?
No, don't go away. My sister, Sherry, she's just so protective. Now it's time for us to once again dip into the mailbag. So the first one reads, "Hi, Dave. I just wanted to advise you that I had trouble finding the survey link in your website, although I did find it in the end. I recommend you make it a large link on your homepage, the first page you see. As it is, it's too hard to find and people may give up." So this is from Lloyd in Australia. And Lloyd, I did go ahead and I put a large link right on the homepage in addition to the show's page. So I do hope people are finding it. Lloyd went on in a follow-up to write, "In regards to the negative review on iTunes, obviously it is written by somebody used to the maniac energy of commercial radio. Your tone is relaxed and informal and may come across to these kinds of listeners as bored or uninterested. Of course, all your loyal listeners love your interview style and wouldn't change a thing. Well, thank you for that support, Lloyd. Yeah, sometimes I get that feedback on my voice. I think people who know me just know this is how I talk. I'm not a trained radio personality. And by the way, thanks to all of you who did go onto iTunes and put on some more positive comments. I've got 19 up there now, most of them very positive, and it boosted my rating. So thanks to all of you for that. Now here's another letter that says, Dr. Dave, it was like a light bulb turned on when I heard about positive psychology. My whole life I've been fascinated with psychology, but mostly about optimization, self-fulfillment, and what the Buddhists call enlightenment, which I believe is a psychological practice, not a religion. Now my focus has a name, positive psychology. I sure hope you have another positive psychologist on your show, as I feel you failed to ask the most important question, how has positive psychology affected the psychology student or the guest? This more than empirical evidence would speak volumes about its effectiveness to me. Well, let me respond to that part. You know, that's a good point. In many of the early shows, I often asked my guests, well, how has this affected you in your life? And that would have been a good question to use in this particular interview on positive psychology, and I forgot to do it. So thanks for that reminder. A writer goes on to say, it would be interesting to do a longitudinal study on depression, anxiety, and satisfaction on freshman positive psychology students through to 1 year after their graduation with a group of clinical psychology students as a control. Okay, well, there's a master's thesis for somebody. He goes on to write, also some other important questions. One, how does positive psychology apply the principles of its findings? Specific examples. Two, how could positive psychology be applied to clinical psychology, i.e. mood disorders? Three, what does the guest think about Tony Robbins and his like? These guys were positive psychology, to everyone ignorant of humanistic psychology like me before now. This question may be naive and self-evident, empirical versus pop, but since this is my only frame of reference, contrasting the difference would be very helpful in sorting out what is tested and what is junk. Once again, Dr. Dave, you've pulled a magic rabbit out of the hat. Thanks for keeping psychology so interesting. And that's from Jonathan in Las Vegas. And he adds, P.S., have you tried to get the author Dan Millman on your show? Many people know him as a writer of the Peaceful Warrior series, but not as many know he graduated from Berkeley with a master's degree in psychology. He would be a good one to talk with about more very positive psychological issues. Thanks very much for all of those great suggestions, Jonathan, in Las Vegas. And as a matter of fact, I am trying to follow up with a clinical psychologist who my positive psychology guest, Dr. James Powelski, mentioned, who teaches in the master's program in applied positive psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, and who we'll be able to talk about applications of positive psychology in clinical practice. So I intend to follow up with her and see if I can bring her on as a guest. Next, we hear again from Susie, who writes, Hi, Dr. Dave. First, I wanted to say how excited I was that you answered my question on air. I had a good think about what you said, and I think I've come to some answers about why I gossip. Listeners may remember Susie's questions about gossiping and my reply. She goes on to say, the first is to find out about others in my social area, most likely in order to gauge where I stand, also so I can learn which behaviors are acceptable and which are not. So I agree in this sense that it serves a social function, which I find ironic because how many times have you heard, I don't care what other people are saying? Should we instead be saying, listen to gossip, it will teach you how to behave in society? I think an excellent example is homeschooled children. I often remember them not fitting in high school, although I'm sure they succeed later in life. I was teased quite a bit in school, and I think it taught me some very important social skills. Anyway, I digress. My second thought as to why I gossip is more specific to work than, say, gossip with friends. I believe gossip is a socially acceptable way to bond with coworkers. I think it is very important to bond with coworkers, especially since you can't bond with them in ways that you would bond with a friend, like, say, sharing secrets or a breakup. So I think negative bonding, gossip, could be replaced with more positive ways, like going to the pub for lunch, sharing a hobby, or simply complimenting a coworker, like, "Sharon, you are so good at this. Would you mind showing me your trick?" Either way, I find almost impossible not to gossip. I think the term verbal vomit describes it best. By the way, Dr. Dave, I have you partially to blame for a mid-20s crisis. I absolutely love psychology, and your show has opened my eyes to a whole new juicy world. The only problem is I'm 8 months into a master's in chemistry. The idea of going back to school and getting a psychology degree and then on to graduate school is so daunting. However, I believe if you are passionate about the subject, which I no longer feel for chemistry, the motivation will come on its own. Keep the podcasts coming. Your faithful listener, Susie. Well, Susie, thanks for those self-reflections on the role of gossip in your life. And I've also sent you a journal article to further stimulate your thinking about it. And say, if you want to go on in psychology, then I say go for it. Karen, a listener in Virginia, writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday. I'm finally able to catch up on my podcast listening and heard you mention about not putting the PodSafe music in the podcast. Although I understand your concern, but if you have it at the end of the podcast, those who do not want to listen can just end their listening. If you enjoy finding the songs, I certainly have no objection to listening to them. I need to tell you that I'm a musician, so I may be biased. I very much enjoy both episodes 60 and 61. Keep up the good work. Best regards, Karen." And then I sent her a follow-up question saying, "Yeah, but did you like the PodSafe music?" And then she replied saying, "Yes, she did like the PodSafe music." So you know what? I think maybe I'll throw the PodSafe music in from time to time. I won't do it all the time, but when I come across a song that I particularly like or I think is particularly apt, maybe I'll throw it in on occasional episodes, and that way we'll satisfy both camps, my camp and the rest of you. No, actually, the survey suggests that about 50% of listeners are on the positive side in regard to the PodSafe music at the end of the show, and 50% are kind of on the less positive side, shall we say. So we'll just compromise and do it a little bit both ways. Near in New York City writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, how are you? Since I've downloaded 30 programs at once, it is taking me a while to catch up. I've just finished listening to the Shamanic Psychology program. In the program, you ask what people may think of going back to such ancient or primitive methods as shamanism. I think that Ken Wilber addresses this subject exactly with his map of consciousness." And he gives a web link to Ken Wilber, which I'm sure you can find on your own. "Especially in the lower left quadrant, interior collective cultural developmental sequences. I highly recommend learning about Ken Wilber and his material. He ties many of the current theories and sciences into one beautiful structure, and it would be wonderful if you could interview him as well. I also wanted to get you interested in the subject of Kabbalah. Not too many people really know what it is about. While it seems to be a new trend for celebrities such as Madonna, when really studying what it is actually contains answers to the deepest questions and is a science that ties together many other fields such as physics, philosophy, religion, psychology," and he gives a link to www.kabbalah.info. "As always, it is a pleasure listening to your podcasts. Keep in touch, Nir." Nir, I'm particularly interested in your comment that you took the time to download 30 shrink wrap radio episodes at once. That must have been a time-consuming job, and it gives me the opportunity to announce a new way for folks to get back issues of shrink wrap radio. A podcaster friend has started a new service where he will sell CDs of archived shows. So within the next few days, you'll be able to purchase the MP3 files for Shrink Wrap Radio episodes 1 through 25 and 26 through 50 on two CDs. You can purchase one or both for a fairly nominal price. So many of you may find this a more convenient way to get past shows. They also might make good gifts for special friends, and you'll find these, as I say, within a couple of days on the website www.poddisc.com. That's PODDISC.com. And in relation to Ken Wilber, I agree that he would make a great guest. I'll see if I can network my way to him. And also I agree that the Kabbalah would make an excellent topic for the show. So I'll keep an ear to the ground for a good guest in that department as well. Finally, I want to end with an email response from longtime listener Ken Valerio to the previous interview with Randy Gage, the Millionaire Messiah. Ken writes, "Hey, Dr. Dave, God, that guy makes my skin crawl. These money-based gurus are so bad for us, for society. I was glad you pointed out at the end of the interview some of your own feelings about having enough and how many of us are richer than most of the world. His total lack of humility and his driving interest in his own wealth. Oh, you know where I'm going. As a listener, I could only handle a show like this maybe every 10 times. You know I love your show, Dr. Dave, and I'm glad you aren't afraid of provocative people, but I also know you like to hear what your listeners are really thinking." That's true. "I feel like I need a shower. I have no disdain for wealth and prosperity, but I would find it hard to compare him to Bono or those comedians who organize comic relief. Extravagance in the face of global poverty is a far greater sin than any he is able to identify. Now I'll get off my soapbox. I wrote about the myth of infinite capacity in one of my books. I'll paste the link to the chapter in case you're interested, as it relates to the idea of prosperity and some common myths." And indeed, I did read that very interesting chapter, and listeners can read it too if you go to www.kenvalerio.com. It's spelled KenVallerio.com. You'll find links to Ken's artwork and also to this book that he refers to. So I think with that, I will wrap it up for today. You know, we love getting your emails, and you can send them to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemails on Skype where our name is ShrinkPod. Alternatively, you are encouraged to leave your voice messages on MyChingo, and you'll find a link to that on our Shrink Wrap Radio website. Thanks for all your help growing our audience by spreading the word about Shrink Wrap Radio. And I want to thank our guest, Jesse O'Neill, for the interview. And I want to let you know that my next guest will be an American psychologist working in Finland who has developed a biochemical treatment for alcoholism and other addictions. This one should have particular appeal for those of you interested in the scientific side of psychology. Also, if you have any friends or family suffering from addiction, you'll want to be sure to listen. So that's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.